Today, a look back at the best TV, music and books in 2020, what you might have missed and what we have to look forward to. One of my favourite episodes we made this year came out in May, when I spoke to three of our culture writers about what they recommended for us to read, listen to and watch in lockdown. Now, as many of us take some days off for our annual Christmas hibernation, which, restrictions depending, may be extended beyond the holidays, we thought it was worth finding out what's out there to entertain us over the next few weeks. Guardian Assistant TV editor Amar Kalia reviews the best shows of the year. Guardian Booksite editor Sean Kane has a host of reading suggestions. And Deputy Music Editor Laura Snapes revels in a year of great pop and disco. From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, a look back at culture in 2020. I think most of us spent at least some of this year trying to pretend it wasn't happening, honestly. And so I thought we'd start with culture that helped us to escape. Laura, how did music come to the rescue?
It was a really strange year in that a lot of albums that were evidently finished in 2019 or at the start of this year had a really either escapist or nostalgic vibe to them. So like Dua Lipa's Future Nostalgia, that's one of the first big albums to come out in the pandemic. Coming up. One of the biggest songs of this year actually came out late last year, but really dominated early lockdown, is The Weeknd's Blinding Lights, which is a very kind of like 80s influenced, gloomy song, which has definitely got a lot of like claustrophobic vibe to it, which I think resonated this year. It was the start of like a really big disco revival this year. There was the Rasheen Murphy album, which had maybe a more bleak take on disco, but still a very good one. Ever since we broke up, I've been afraid to go out. The Kylie Minogue album, which was just called Disco, like a real return to core values. There was a lot of brilliant dance floor escapism. I mean, even down to something like Sophie Ellis-Bextor's brilliant kitchen disco, which is the only live stream I routinely tuned in for.
Good evening, thank you for coming to party with us tonight. Let's start with a nice disco song about Scientology, shall we? Hell yeah.
Yeah, that was just such a surprise hit, wasn't it? And it is amazing that all these disco albums have come out in a year where none of us have been able to go out dancing.
You know, it is cyclical. I feel like there's a disco revival every so often. But I mean, it really fits because I guess disco is all about you want the night to never end. You're on this dance floor because you're probably escaping something else. And although we could not escape to the dance floor, we could escape to the dance floor of the mind.
Amma, what were you watching to block out 2020?
I always do that annoying thing where if someone tells me there's something that I would like, I never watch it or listen to it. And this year was the year that my friend Emily finally got through to me with Schitt's Creek.
I once dated someone who left me for a stuffed animal. I'm not having my big day, our big day, compromised because Alexis wanted to chill in a tankini for 6 months.
Schitt's Creek is a comedy set in Canada made by Eugene Levy, who's probably best known for his role as the dad in American Pie, and his son Dan Levy. And it's about this incredibly wealthy family who lose all their money. And they lose all their assets apart from a town that they bought years ago that's worth nothing called Schitt's Creek. And they move back to this town.
Thank you, Rose.
There is value in these motels. My family and I have been staying in a motel for the past 3 years. And I wouldn't trade our stay there for anything.
And it's just this like incredibly heartwarming, lovely show. The episodes are half an hour long. And I think, yeah, in lockdown, it was just really nice to kind of watch something that was so divorced from the horrors of reality.
Sean, what books have done well this year?
one of the biggest hits of the year has been Thursday Murder Club by Richard Osman from Pointless.
I genuinely thought, and listen, you'll know what I'm talking about, I thought the world doesn't need another TV presenter writing a novel, right? It's not the kind
of... Why would you do that?
His book is all about a bunch of pensioners who start solving crimes, and like obviously he wasn't writing that in any way to comfort people, and he wasn't writing that with any idea of what would happen in 2020, but you know, there's a real sense that he's having fun with it, and that book has taken off in a massive way. And I think it's sort of perfect in that weird thing that we often try and seek out at Christmas time, sort of like cozy murders.
Yeah, just because it's been a difficult year hasn't meant that people haven't wanted to engage with things that are a bit darker. Amar, there were some really anticipated dramas that aired this autumn, weren't there? I've been watching Industry, which gets pretty bleak at points.
Industry's, well, for me, was surprisingly intense, actually. It's about a group of young graduates at a London bank, London investment firm, and their kind of competition between each other to secure a job.
Young people are our capital. Just make yourselves indispensable.
It sort of descends into this craven exploration of working in this kind of macho environment with a lot of partying, a lot of drugs, a lot of sex.
No rest for the wicked.
Nothing good ever happens past 2 a.m.
Everything good happens past 2 a.m.
Lena Dunham directed the first episode and she's an executive producer. It's written by two former bankers. The music's by Nathan McKay, who's great. Kind of electronic producer. He sort of weaves in the sounds of like the landline phones ringing on their desks. So it kind of creates this really unsettling, hyper-modern setting, I think, for the show, which works really well.
Do I just say done?
Half a yard done, 4 cents.
Half a yard done, 4 cents.
Let's see where this takes us.
There's been a lot of debate as to obviously it's exaggerated, but I feel like it's sort of exaggerated in just the right kinds of ways. I kind of think if you're from London or for kind of any kind of big city, you sort of know people who've gone through jobs like that. They've kind of come out the other end, either broken or just a totally different person.
Sian, the Booker Prize this year was won by a gritty novel, Shuggie Bain, by Douglas Stewart, about growing up in Glasgow in the 1980s with a mother who is addicted to alcohol. What did you make of it and why do you think it won?
He's a really interesting winner, I think. And there were some cynical predictions beforehand that were saying, you know, he's not going to win because he's the only white bloke on the shortlist this year. But when the judges were speaking about it afterwards, they made the point that his depiction of poverty is so affecting. It really avoids any what you might call like poverty porn, like sort of mawkishness. And I think that's possibly because it's rooted in his own experiences. His mother died when he was a teenager.
I'd like to, first of all, just thank my mother. I think I've been clear that my mother is in every page of this book. And without her, I wouldn't be here and my work wouldn't be here.
When he won, he was so grateful to Scotland and he kept sort of thanking the people of Scotland and talking about the national character and how that's led him to become the person that he is.
I know I'm only the second Scottish book in 50 years to have won, and that means I think a lot for regional voices, for working class stories, and so thank you.
You know, I think any of those six books could have won, but I think it was a particularly uplifting story to win.
Another landmark book this year has been Barack Obama's A Promised Land, which he released the week after the US election.
I wanted to tell a more personal story that might inspire young people considering a life of public service. How my career in politics really started with a search for a place to fit in.
What insights do we get into his time in the White House?
Not a lot. I mean, Barack Obama's presidency was obviously very well documented, and I think there is a certain reluctance on Obama's part to really examine his failures. He's not necessarily candid in the way that you might hope for him to be, given that he's, you know, safely out of the job. And I think cynically, it's part of the Obama brand.
I'm sure people will find this book inspiring, though, won't they? Especially in a year where Obama's vice president, Joe Biden, won the election.
Yes. I guess he's a symbol of hope for people. He's a remarkable orator, and I think because we've had Trump for 4 years, it's very easy to get swept up by a charismatic man that knows stuff. But I would recommend anyone listening read Gary Young's review of A Promised Land. I just don't think that he was as successful a president as perhaps some of us on the left would really have liked him to have been.
Laura, Barack Obama's book came out in a year where conversations about race and racism have been happening in the mainstream in a way I think they haven't before. How have artists reflected on this?
We saw certain tracks revamped very quickly, like DaBaby had been number one for ages in America with the song Rockstar. Brand new Lamborghini, a cop car, with a pistol on my hip like I'm a cop. He very quickly put out a Black Lives Matter remix with Roddy Ricch on it. And he talked about how he had been harassed by police and embarrassed by them throughout his life. Cops want to pull me over, embarrass me, abusing power. You never knew me, thought I was arrogant. An issue that was certainly related was the breakthrough of Megan Thee Stallion. Now get your boots, hang your coat, fuck this wet and gushy. He bought a phone just for pictures of this wet and gushy. She was allegedly shot by the rapper Tory Lanez. And there was a really horrible response to it on certain parts of social media, like a lot of mockery, a lot of disbelief, a lot of people saying that she was doing it to further her career and so on. And she came out and she made really powerful statements about why it was important to protect Black women. When she appeared on Saturday Night Live for the first time this summer, she used part of her performance to talk about Breonna Taylor and to talk about how the Black woman is the most unprotected person in America, which was really powerful. And she wrote an editorial for the New York Times about it as well. And I think that delved into a side of the issue that is not necessarily always talked about.
Amar, this year has seen more Black stories also being explored on TV, all of which were made before George Floyd's death. And most recently, Steve McQueen's series Small Acts has aired on the BBC.
This attack on a Black establishment is not an isolated event, but a sustained campaign against Black people.
How significant do you think that is?
Yeah, I think that's huge, actually. It can't really be overstated that it's, I mean, it's interesting that it's been considered a TV show because it's actually just five sort of feature length films. So like a massive undertaking of work shown on like primetime BBC television, kind of exploring the sort of historical significance of like West Indian, West African communities in Britain. One of the episodes or films is about Leroy Logan, who set up the kind of Black Metropolitan Police Commissioners group.
Lord, may you protect your servant, Leroy. Please keep him safe for his police training.
Attention!
And grant us the wisdom to accept his decision.
But then there's also just some great stories of just Black joy and Black life. So Lovers Rock is one of the films that I personally really loved, which is just set in kind of a big house party in West London. And I just thought it was kind of incredible to see A, sort of just Black people lit properly on the screen. I think there's such an issue with just lighting and framing and the way that non-white skin is shown. So that was kind of great just to see that the aesthetics were treated properly. The music was really centered. Yeah, this is something that Steve McQueen was working with since like 2012. So in that way, Small Acts, I think, is really important because it's not tokenistic. It's kind of a work of deep care and emotion and lived experience.
And that's certainly something that we saw in one of the other huge hits of this year, also on iPlayer, I May Destroy You, which was based at least in part on its creator Michaela Cole's own experience of having been sexually assaulted. This is a clip of her character Arabella being interviewed at a police station.
Do you have any reason to believe that this friend of yours, Simon, or DeRay would spike your drinks? I want to hurt you in any way.
No. There were another two. We didn't know them, so I don't know. It wouldn't have been Simon. He's my friend. He's one of my best friends. He really is.
The show won praise for lots of reasons, including the fact that it centres on a group of young Black people. And it shows them going through things that I've never seen on TV before.
I mean, it's incredible because I think the story of Michaela Cole getting it to screen after it's been shown, been revealed at how different broadcasters tried to take control and kind of convince her out of the rights to her own show. So the fact that she managed to keep that control is incredible. And yeah, and then I think just kind of showing there's a great episode where it centres on Papa Sidhu's character. He plays a gay black man in the show. It sort of touches on a period of assault. I won't give too much away for people who haven't seen it, but everything is so delicately handled, but not in a way that makes it feel like they're papering over the cracks. So,
this was about 3 weeks ago, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. What was the name of the suspect?
I don't know.
Oh, you don't know?
We met on Grindr. So I have his address.
What was his name on that?
No one uses their real name. You put in a username.
I think that show hits really hard and straight to the gut, but it doesn't feel exhibitionist. That's very much down to Michaela Cole's writing, and her acting as well, I think, is really incredible in it.
Sean, some of the biggest selling books this year have been nonfiction. In the summer, we had Renier de Lodge on the podcast talking about becoming the first Black British author to top the UK bestseller list with Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race.
It's a source of conflict for me to know that suddenly a whole bunch of people have been brought to my work through watching someone die on camera. That's very disturbing.
How do you reflect on the renewed interest in the book?
Obviously, Renier de Lodge's book, it really took off its own back a few years ago. And there has been a spate of publishing since to try and emulate that success. But then with Black Lives Matter, she shot to the top of the charts and she was at number one on the overall book charts for a couple of weeks, I think. And with her, there were so many what you might call black reading lists that were being produced afterwards. And there's an author called Eteke Wagba. She wrote a book which is called Whites on Race and Other Falsehoods. And she has talked really interestingly about black reading lists, and she thinks that they're good for white people in that they further an academic understanding of race, but they don't necessarily translate into action. You know, you asked me about me reflecting on it. It's like, I think that a lot of people did some good reading this year, and authors like Akala for his book Natives that went up the charts. You know, David Olusoga, books about slavery and racism that were published this year have all done really well. But in terms of reflecting on what that translates into, I agree maybe with Otego Wagba that I don't know whether that turns into any kind of activism. It might do.
Yeah, I think it was something actually that Nisheen Iqbal said to us on the podcast earlier this year that, you know, she hoped it wouldn't just be about people going out and reading manuals on how not to be racist, but actually just reading amazing stories written by black people about black people.
I think the interesting thing is that there was a bump in fiction as well. Bernardine Evaristo has been a big seller because she won the Booker last year, but there was a bump in sales for her book Girl, Woman, Other again. And then authors like Candice Carty-Williams and even Toni Morrison, like, and I would be kind of interested in seeing what fiction does to a person when it comes to one's understanding of racism and anti-racism. I think it is uniquely positioned to extend our understanding of other people in a way that perhaps a history of slavery might not.
Coming up, how lockdown has changed art this year and what this will mean for what we're watching, listening to and reading in 2021. Emma, after a pause at the start of lockdown, there were lots of shows made this year against the odds, really. What would you pick out as some of your COVID TV moments?
Oh, I think people struggled to make live TV. That was a thing that was very difficult without an audience. So I think long-standing shows like Have I Got News For You, or even Graham Norton, I think really kind of didn't fare very well without an audience. But, you know, I think Grayson Perry had Grayson's Art Club on Channel 4.
I'm Grayson Perry. I'm an artist and this is my art club. I believe that art can help get us through this crisis.
He'd bring in special guests every week to make a piece of art and then encourage people at home to kind of make it as well.
I'll pick some of the works that you send me to create an exhibition in the real world once this crisis is over.
I mean, it's like a return to kids' TV, basically. Like, the kids' TV format worked quite well because it was interactive. I also thought Alan Yentob's Imagine series, they did a kind of special episode profiling the Kanemason family. Sheka Kanemason is probably the most well-known of that family, who is the cellist that played at Harry and Meghan's wedding. He's got six siblings, and they're all really talented classical musicians.
With the pandemic came cancelled concerts and closed schools. With nothing more than their mobile phones, they've been streaming live, inspiring millions with their love of classical music.
So there was this one documentary episode film, which they kind of remotely filmed from home, and it was a concert interspersed with interviews with their parents and with all the kids. And that was just really beautiful, I thought. I thought it was a really nice way of like documenting the lockdown.
Netflix, Amazon and iPlayer aside for a moment, Amar, some of the biggest TV moments this year were not works of fiction, were they? But simply events that were happening around us.
Yeah, I mean, I've never experienced so many breaking news alerts on TV and kind of cutting to briefings and newsreaders having to fill time.
The Prime Minister's chief advisor, he's coming into the Downing Street garden now.
Obviously, you have Dominic Cummings's Rose Garden appearance.
We agreed that we should go for a short drive to see if I could drive safely. We drove for roughly half an hour and ended up on the outskirts of Barncastle Town.
By now, I think the briefings have just become like this horrible reminder of the weird existence that we live.
It is with a very heavy heart, I must tell you, we cannot continue with Christmas as planned.
Sian, when you were last on the podcast, you predicted that there would be lots of pandemic books rushed out this year. Has that happened?
Yes, actually. Yeah, there has been quite a little boom in science writing. There are a couple books that sort of were just timed very well. So there was Adam Kucharski's The Rules of Contagion. That's done very well.
And aside from books about pandemics and about what we're going through, have we all just been reading and buying more books this year? I mean, I know I have.
Ebooks and audiobooks surged massively compared to last year. Print sales were actually down this year, but when you look at specific subsections of those figures, people were buying more novels than other years. These numbers are better than 2019 when bookshops were open. A lot of those sales have been driven by Amazon. And for some of the physical retailers that sell books that somehow have circumnavigated the rules of all the tiers and lockdowns and things, so places like WH Smith and supermarkets that sell books, they have been able to stay open where bookshops have had to close. And so one interesting development this year was the launch of bookshop.org. It's an online retailer. Authors and independent bookshops can make little shop fronts on there. And it's basically trying to siphon off some sales from Amazon.
Laura, we talked earlier in the year about how the pandemic affected artists who suddenly found themselves in a world without festivals or gigs. But how has COVID changed the way that they've actually been able to record music in 2020?
We've seen loads of people recording at home. I think the first artist to do something like that in lockdown was Charlie XCX, who is a self-professed absolute workaholic, cannot imagine sitting still for 5 minutes, and she knew that she would lose her mind if she didn't get to work during this pandemic. So she set herself the challenge of making an entire album from scratch in a month. And she did it in this really interesting way where it was hugely collaborative. Like, I don't know when she slept, because she was always like on Instagram Live telling fans about what was going on. And she was also taking fans' tracks to try and like make songs to herself and like accepting remixes and artwork. It was really cool, like an amazing collaborative project. And she did it. She made her deadline. The album was called How I'm Feeling Now. And the best song on it really sums up, especially those early days of the pandemic. It's called Anthems, and the first line is just her yelling, "I'm so bored." I'm so bored. Wake up late, eat some cereal, try my best to be physical, lose myself in a TV show, staring out to oblivion. While she was doing that, we did not know about this at the time, but Taylor Swift was making what would turn out to be one of two lockdown albums made this year. I think she is probably the artist who has been most freed up from not having to play live and not having to interact with the public either, because she's like the most presidential pop star we've got. Like, I've been in a room with her, and when she's meeting somebody for the first time, like, she knows stuff about you. She'll know, like, if you've had your hair cut or, like, where you live or, like, little details. You know how in, like, The West Wing or something you'll see one of President Bartlett's advisors whisper in his ear if somebody's approaching? She's like that.
I also love this idea that loads of musicians were struggling to make one album, and then Taylor was like, "I did two. But anyway.
Totally, yeah. So I think this year, not having to do any of that kind of stuff, even Kylie Minogue as well, who's been doing this for like more than 30 years, she said that I think she was about 4/5 finished with her album Disco. And then I interviewed her and she said that they were in a studio in Brighton on the day before lockdown and they all kind of said goodbye to each other, not knowing if they would see each other in a few weeks or, as has transpired, not at all. And so she had to teach herself to record at home and do a bit of engineering. And I think that's amazing that, you know, somebody who's, I think she's 52, has learned new skills this year and, you know, given herself like a new form of agency over the work that she's made.
Some musicians produced quite a lot, but others struggled to write, didn't they, and struggled with their creativity.
Yeah, definitely. So we always do a year in music roundtable, which usually takes place in real life, but obviously this year had to take place on Zoom. We had like Danielle from Haim and Rina Sawayama, Declan McKenna, but people were saying in there really candidly that like seeing Charlie XCX put out an album like that made them feel a bit bad for like, oh god, like why am I not being productive, why am I not doing anything in this time? But you know, I'm really interested to see next year what kind of music is going to come out, because obviously everybody's lived through the same thing this year, but who's going to want to relive this experience in pop music? I feel like we're going to get more escapism and more fantasy.
And what music have we got to look forward to next year?
There's not a lot of huge stuff that's been announced yet. I guess people are really hedging their bets after this year, but two that have been announced are the new album by The Weather Station, who is a Canadian musician called Tamara Lindemann. She's kind of been in a more Americana vein for like her whole career, basically. But this new album, it's more, there's more synths on it. It really sounds a lot like Kate Bush's The Sensual World. It's amazing. The one that I'm most excited about is there is a new St. Vincent album coming. There's no details or anything, but she did a little interview in Mojo magazine where she talked about some of the kind of funk influences that are part of it, like Sly and the Family Stone. From what I know, it's completely different to anything that she's done before, and I think it's going to be brilliant.
Oh, that sounds amazing. And Sian, are there books coming out that you're looking forward to or that you'd point us to?
I'll give a sort of little brief list, just because so many books from 2020 were moved to 2021, obviously because publishers were worried about bookshops being closed. So there's kind of an insane roster of names: a new Colson Whitehead, a new Jonathan Franzen, a new Colm Toyby, a new Rachel Cusk, a new Maggie Nelson, a new Kazuo Ishiguro. And the other book I would say, which is coming out in January, so that's not too long to wait, is Luster by Raven Leilani. It's a debut novel. There's a lot of buzz around it. It's about a young black girl called Edie, you know, crappy job and sleeping with a lot of crappy guys. She doesn't really have a sense of direction. And then she meets this guy called Eric, who is like this middle-aged guy who is in an open relationship. They start dating and she sort of comes into their family home. And it's a really interesting dissection of race and gender. It's just such a really funny and sad and really sharp book. And I think it's going to be really big over here.
An overwhelming number of books for us all to look forward to next year. And Amar, I mean, it's been difficult for people to make new shows this year, but is there stuff coming out in 2021?
One of the big ones is Russell T Davies' new series called It's a Sin, which is starring Ollie Alexander. He's the singer from the band Years and Years. And that's kind of all about a group of teens who moved to London in the 80s, and it's about the AIDS crisis.
There are boys dying all over the world, but no one knows anything.
Do you seriously think there's an illness that only kills gay men?
I don't believe it!
Now hit me with those lasers, please!
And then one that I'm quite excited about, which is a bit weird, is Painting with John.
It's important to have fun.
Which is actually an HBO Max release. I'm not quite sure when that's going to come over to the UK, but it's about John Lurie, who is a sort of underground musician and director and painter. And it just, it's like a very sweet and lovely series, kind of following him around in his sort of self-described hermit life painting.
I live on this small island in the Caribbean. It's beautiful here.
Okay, sounds lovely. And finally, Laura, no pressure, but the big question of the whole interview is going to go to you. Tomorrow, after 26 years of waiting, will Mariah Carey finally get her sought-after Christmas number one that I think, honestly, she rightly deserves?
I don't want a lot for
She got her first UK number one with that song a couple of weeks ago, and she could get the Christmas number one tomorrow. I think she's got hot competition from Lad Baby with another Sausage Roll themed song, which is for charity for the Trussell Trust, and the NHS Choirs and Justin Bieber, which is also for charity. Mariah Carey is not for charity, but maybe this is really bad, but I would still quite like her to do it. I feel like there needs to be a bit of ceremony around the Christmas number one, and she provides nothing if not ceremony.
Laura, Amar and Sian, thank you so much for speaking to me, and Merry Christmas.
Oh,
Merry Christmas.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Sian Kane, Amar Kalia and Laura Snapes. Go to theguardian.com to read all their reviews and roundups of the year in culture. And you can also find Amar's first book, a collection of jazz poems, at amarkalia.bandcamp.com. Thanks to all of them for speaking to me. This episode was produced by Hannah Moore and sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. Tomorrow may be a very different December the 25th for those of you who celebrate Christmas. I'm unable to see my family and I know how hard it is to not be with loved ones at this time of year. I hope you enjoy it wherever you are and whatever you're doing. Before I go, thank you to Dan for his lovely email about what the podcast has meant to him this year, and to all of you who have tweeted or contacted Anushka and I over the last few months. That's it for this week, but we will be back on Monday when we'll be revisiting some of our favourite episodes from the past 12 months. I hope you have a very Merry Christmas.